Next up, we have Mike Aziz, I think, presenting the impact proposal, correct?
Yes.
Excellent. Mike Aziz from Oregon Health Science University.
Cool, thanks. All right, good morning. That was a perfect segue, Kai, thank you, because this is about the opioid crisis. I'm Mike Aziz. I'm the co-PI of this study proposal, along with Miriam Treggiari from OHSU. We're here to present not an abstract, but a study proposal. This is the optimized opioid management or usual treatment to reduce opioid use following surgery opt-out, the pragmatic patient-centered trial. We have nothing to disclose, but this study is now supported with seed funding from the AUA, IRS. We have some other support in terms of research funding unrelated to this. So back to this crisis, we talked about this a little bit in this last session. This is a national crisis, right? Many people are dying every day in the United States from opioid overdose. The CDC reports that this isn't just heroin. This is a problem related to prescription medicine as well. The acute pain setting is often the initial exposure. And we talked about what an alarming rate is. This is from Michigan, actually, Chad Brumman's group and others. But the rate of persistent opioid use following elective surgical procedures in opioid-naive patients is somewhere between 6 and 15%, closer to 6 for minor surgical procedures. But I mean, I think even this is alarmingly high. I mean, who knows if it's up to 50%, but this is an alarmingly high rate in observational studies we've seen. We know that opioids are overprescribed. A large proportion of opioids are unused after surgery. And we know that opioids aren't the only answer, right? The multimodal approaches are superior. And we know that patient engagement can make a difference. In terms of tackling this question and why did we need to get at this, that little research has really evaluated the patient's experience regarding their pain when asking about opioid prescription. Instead, there's regulatory oversight. Insurance carriers and others are telling us that this is the number of opioid pills that can be prescribed after surgery, and that's not informed by the patient's experience, their level of pain, or how we as providers are interacting with our patients. We believe that a multidisciplinary team informed by anesthesiologists, pain experts, can help reduce post-surgical pain, opioid consumption, and the amount of opioid available in the community, those pills that are sitting in the medicine cabinet for people to divert. So the primary question is, can a post-operative pain management plan effectively treat surgical pain while reducing the amount of opioid prescription after discharge and improving patient satisfaction with pain management? We've built that out into our hypotheses to be tested. So compared with a fixed prescription plan, essentially what the oversight is recommending, 20 pills after a lap coli, can a more thoughtful, tailored approach that uses a shared decision-making model, one, reduce the amount of opioid consumed at 30, 90 days following discharge, improve the pain and quality of life at several key endpoints in the study, and reduce the amount of unused opioid available in the community after a take-back program. So we propose a pragmatic, multi-center, randomized controlled trial enrolling more than 1,600 previously opioid-naive patients undergoing elective surgery with short hospital stay with a planned discharge home. This is also we can engage them and follow up with them. The randomization will be traditional study design, randomized in one-to-one fashion to this prescription plan versus fixed dosing. Our study endpoints, primary endpoint is oral morphine equivalents consumed at 30 days after hospital discharge. Multiple secondary endpoints related to pain, quality of life, sleep, anxiety, the amount of oral morphine equivalents unused and unreturned. And then similar outcomes at 90 days. So in terms of the study procedure, study sequence, all patients will receive some opioid safety education in the form of a brochure. We're going to use a phone application to help track all of our outcome measures. We're going to have them download that application on their phone, and we'll go ahead and randomize at the time of enrollment. At the time of discharge, the patients will be followed to collect study endpoints. They'll receive financial incentive when they complete each endpoint because, as we saw with Kai's work, you know, even a persistent phone call sometimes misses the data. Patients just won't answer their phone. So we need to find a better way to get information on our patients postoperatively. And then they'll be offered some mechanism for take back. And this might look different at all the different sites that participate, but there needs to be some mechanism for take back. In terms of the randomization, in the intervention group at the time of enrollment, there'll be a bit more robust education process. The patient will be informed a bit better about pain management expectations for their surgical procedure. In the control group, no additional intervention. At the time of discharge, the intervention group will be engaged by a prescription management team that uses a shared decision-making model to tailor the prescription to that patient's needs based on their newly formed expectations. Whereas at the time of discharge, patients in the control group will be given what's essentially an average total dose of opioids. So if the average dose of average number of pills after lap cholecystectomies we find to be 20 pills, that's what they'll get. This is the study schedule to kind of show our patient tracking. We heard about this morning. This is the Prosper app. We've engaged with them to determine if this build will work for us. Actually, most of these opioid questionnaires are already in there for another study that they're conducting. We're trying to figure out if we can do some of these other things like payment incentive within the app. We're also exploring our own app build. So what's new here, and why do we think this has some hope of getting funding on a large scale? It's engaging the patient, and a lot of the trials really fail to do so. And a lot of the trials are really observational. We've seen monthly in major impact journals, more and more observational studies highlighting the problem and speaking to sources of the problem, but not really doing a good job speaking to sources of intervention, which we believe is an engaged team working with a patient. This anesthesiology clinical trials network is new. This was supported along with two other studies that you'll hear a bit more about this afternoon as well. It's new and novel for our field, and MPOG here is the right home, as Sachin mentioned. We've got the right group of clinical investigators. We've been working together for many years now, and I'm proud to be a part of it, and this is the right next step for us as a clinical research consortium. And then patient tracking, you know, we need to move on from the phone questionnaire. Kai just presented this preliminary data from the EOS study. We're going to need that data to help inform what current prescription practices are. Existing literature will help us with this, too, to help define current prescription rates. We've taken some steps since this was funded. At the host institution, we're conducting our own approved observational study to determine more contemporary prescription dosing, again, for the control group. We're doing a broader query of a Kaiser database that we have access to just to provide some external validity to help inform that what we're seeing at our institution matches what's happening at other institutions or other clinical care networks. We need to do some further testing of the application with actual patients, just like Sachin told us that they're doing this morning with the Prosper app. We need to make sure it works for pain questions. And we're exploring funding opportunities. There's a handful of calls from the NIH and others to help tackle this opioid crisis, and we've got our eyes keenly looking at these calls. In terms of environment, we think we're prepared to do this. At the host institution, we've got past and current funding with government-funded trials, including multi-center trials. MPOG is the most robust data coordinating center in the country, and it would serve this project well, likely in a collaborative fashion with our host institution. And several of you have shown interest. We plan on disseminating some feasibility questionnaires to you to see if it makes sense for you to participate. We've heard of some level of interest from these members, some more engaged than others, some simple email questions, I'd like to learn more. So I would encourage you, if you're interested, to join us at 3 o'clock today to learn more and give me more direct feedback than we can do in a couple minutes after this session, and help engage your interest. I just kind of like to point out, if we just drop these institutions on a map, we've got some, Pacific Northwest, we've got some Northeast, I guess we have the time zones covered, but we're missing a good part of the country here. We're missing the heart of the opioid crisis a bit in the Southeast. So I think there's opportunity for us to kind of better capture some of the members in the room, because you've got patients that are suffering from this problem, and it's a national crisis, and we need to represent the nation a little better. That's it. I'm happy to take some questions from you, and by email or now or at 3 o'clock today.
All right. Good work. Michael, it's great stuff that you're doing. Brigham, we'd love to help. What I want to hear, though, is how are you going to square your preliminary data that says 50% of your patients are taking opioids for pain other than the surgical pain 3 months out, and a 5-day prescription? Who's going to answer the phone? So you have this wonderful thing. They've got an app, and they text you, and they say, my prescription's out. It's Friday at midnight. That's the problem that we're dealing with in this particular range. They love for us to be involved. The surgeons want us to answer that. Who amongst your practitioners is going to see that patient and follow up, particularly the patient who has substance use disorder and is going to argue you to the ground at midnight on a Friday night?
Well, I think for purposes of study...
You don't know they have substance use disorder until they're in your trial. That's the patient.
Well, right. These are opioid-naive patients we're trying to enroll. So I'd say two things. For the purpose of this study, hopefully NIH-funded, we've got the resources on the ground handle. We tell our surgeons, we got your back, and the control group, intervention group, the prescription team will handle re-prescription.
So you're going to assemble a team of anesthesiologists who's going to see them in a clinic?
Advanced practice provider, pharmacist, and anesthesia pain
this
provider
is the,
will be part of the prescription team.
Yeah, it's terrific. I really want to see how it works. I'm going to look into you to lead, because we've tried this so many times, and that's where it always falls down.
What I'm worried, when the feedback we got when we presented this at the IRS meeting was, hold on, you are describing something that's going to cost each institution thousands of dollars. How is this transferable to, this community practice next door that isn't part of your trial, and how are they going to move forward? We believe that we can inform a surgical community or whoever's doing the prescription, it might be primary care, that this is how it looks. If you prescribe X, they will refill, with this frequency, or they might not. We believe that pain will be less with a thoughtful prescription practice, that we won't have these alarming rates of postoperative pain or use. You prescribe less, they use less. So.
But it's still, what I'm getting at is that you're focusing on the positives.
I want you to focus
on that 1% that fail. I mean, I'm a chronic pain specialist. That's what I deal with every day. And
right.
So who's going to wrestle that group to the ground? And who's going to be the front line for that group that wrestles with this problem? And we need to. This is critically important to the success of this.
I mean, for the purpose of the study, again, it's going to be this team. I think in practical medicine, they are going to continue to need the expertise of pain physicians like you who will be a resource to the surgeons and offer to see patients that are not, they're not the success story.
Oh, hi. I applaud the protocol. Nathan from Utah here. My question has to do with the institutions, since they'll all be places where there's awareness of the difficulty of properly giving opioids. Will there be contamination of the control group by physicians not wanting to really do standard care, thus creating a lack of clear distinction between the treatment group and the control group, thus making it difficult to make inferences about the outcome?
So the prescription team is managing both sides. They're managing the control and the intervention, Nathan. So we thought about just letting the surgeons manage the control group, and we worried a bit about contamination. Will they go back to their surgeon if this prescription team's handling it? But we would want you as investigators to engage with your surgeons and say, listen, we need this team to manage the prescription. Will you stay out of it? And, my experience is that most surgeons will say, you want it to be your problem? Sure. I mean, I think some of them have that ownership. They don't want to give it up, and we need to explore that. But I guess it's something to consider, Nathan. I mean, yes, there's some risk of contamination, but I think it's reduced by having the study team managing both arms.
Maybe some clarification there on the previous study, that when it said 50% were still using them, were those patients entering that previous study naive, 50%? Or are they, because it said 40% of the patients were taking opioids before, and then 50% were taking them afterwards. So it seemed like there was a 10% increase, or am I reading it wrong?
Kai.
But in your first part, it said 40% were taking some opioids before, and the study included all these patients. So you could say they may have been taking opioids for no pain before, 40%, and there was an increase in 10%. So maybe it was a 10% increase. If you believe some of the stuff that Chad Brumman's done in Michigan, when you reduce the number of opioids, the patients calling for more opioids is unrelated to whether they were given less. The people that are going to recall for more opioids are ones that are going to call for more opioids, whether you give them 50 or 20. Is that true?
Well, I mean, that's not randomized data, but yeah, that's what he's observed. And so there's, I think, good reason to believe that this will follow, that if we prescribe less, they'll need less, they'll consume less, and they'll have less pain.
And at Michigan, he's rolled this out throughout Michigan, so we'll be kind of a crummy control group, because I don't think they're giving a lot of opioids. The control group will probably have fewer opioids, the same as the treatment group, maybe.
Right. I believe that, and I've seen some work with other studies. It looks like your control group looks like a lot of intervention groups already. But this is why we need multiple centers, because some are more aware of the issue, and this doesn't serve. I can get 1,000 patients in my single center. We need you, because the diversity of care is quite profound in this country, and people are doing all kinds of crazy things, both good and bad.
Excellent. Thank you, Mike. I think the concept of how care gets standardized at different places is really variable. We think is control is somebody else's experimental and vice versa. That's what all of the lung-predictive ventilation and everything has shown.